Let's talk.
John Brown. The CIA Book Club. It reads apparently like a it's entertaining and vivid. It reads like a thriller. It's a new history of the best kept secret of the Cold War, an astonishing story of 10 million books that was smuggled across the Iron Curtain. It's the new book by Charlie English. I am delighted to say that Charlie joins me live on the line now. Charlie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles.
And presumably you are somewhere in no man's land with a smuggled copy of Lady Chatterley's Lover on the border with the former East Germany.
I wish. I'm actually in a caravan in the North Yorkshire Moors, so I'm sort of getting away from it all.
Well, indeed, yeah. That's one way of doing it. Now, what I love about the, you know, we had the end of the Second World War and there's history coming out about that, but we're getting more and more history about the Cold War and stuff that is now being declassified and coming to light. And obviously in these, you know, over 30 years now with the breakup of the Soviet Union, etc. And these stories are coming and they're more and more fantastical than you could possibly imagine. Explain a little bit about the background of this one, please.
Well, yeah, it is a kind of fantastical story. It's, how the CIA spent 35 years, more or less, shipping books into the Eastern Bloc because, of course, in those days, during the Cold War, every East European country was living under a very strict censorship regime. So if you even wanted to get a business card or a wedding invitation published in Poland, for instance, you needed the permission of the censor's office to do so. And the CIA realized that a lot of information was just not getting through to the people of these so-called captive nations in the Eastern Bloc that were under Moscow's yoke. And so they started shipping them in. And some of this stuff was fiction of a kind of political variety, like Orwell's 1984 and Animal Farm, for instance. Some of it was history that wasn't accessible to the people of the Eastern Bloc, and some of it was just kind of lifestyle magazines or you know, copies of Marie Claire and Life and art books and so on. So the idea was to really undermine the kind of grip that that the totalitarian ism of Stalin and people who followed Stalin had on those people, and try and persuade them that life in the West was better.
And can I just say as well that obviously to a younger generation, kids ask your parents, etc., but there is no social media, there is no internet. This is the only way of finding out what is happening. And so you can't simply go onto your mobile phone and click and see, you know, what Vanity Fair is saying this month or what Vogue is saying or getting a chapter of, I'm just imagining the looks when if you're trying to smuggle Animal Farm into this the former Soviet Union. I mean, this really is, you know, there's nothing as dangerous to the totalitarian regimes as an idea or a book, is there?
That's right. And of course, in those days, as you say, it was much more easier to kind of control the flow of information because there wasn't the massive array of digital delivery systems that we have now. So the main propaganda techniques were books and, of course, other publications and radio. In the early 1950s, the CIA started radio stations like Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, which were also targeting the Eastern Bloc. But those were jammable, so you could set up these sort of systems that would stop the radio waves getting into the East. And books smuggled in these kind of vast quantities and through a whole massive array of mechanisms. You know, they were taking them on yachts, they were producing mini editions, which they put in tins of food, which went on humanitarian convoys. So, you know, this kind of plethora of delivery devices was really unstoppable. And when they got to the Eastern Bloc, they were very, as you say, very powerful. I mean, they would circulate among groups of like-minded people, create kind of dissident factions even within societies in the Eastern Bloc, and do the job. I mean, there's one copy of 1984 that I found in a library in Warsaw that had been taken into Poland in the late 50s and had been circulating continuously until the end of the Cold War, so until 1989.
Wow.
And it must have been read by certainly thousands and possibly tens of thousands of people in that time.
With the Cold War at its height, presumably the person who comes up with this idea, I mean, I would think the CIA would say, oh, come on, we're more interested in listening and getting radio stations or dropping arms or you know, the your smileys people sort of surveillance. And so, whose idea was this originally? Was it one person? Was it a body of people? How did the idea come around? And how was it received by sort of the hawks in the CIA, for example?
Well, it emerged from these programs of balloon propaganda drops that they had in the 50s. And these went on for about 5 years, and they launched millions of effectively sort of weather balloons, hot air balloons, that would carry a payload of propaganda leaflets. And they would launch them in the, you know, just on the western side of the Iron Curtain. They'd fly up, reach a certain altitude, and then pop, and then deliver all these leaflets down on Czechoslovakia and so on. I mean, it's kind of Heath Robinson crazy kind of idea. And they dropped tens of millions of leaflets like this, but the leaflets weren't very useful, and people didn't really want to keep the leaflets because they just had a kind of message about freedom and didn't really mean very much. And also the communist authorities, if they caught you with these things, you were in a lot of trouble. But when they started sending books, and they sent a copy of Animal Farm by balloon, I think it was probably one of the first books they ever sent, then people wanted to keep the books, and they had they wanted to hold on to them, and they had some value. And from there, they developed a whole system of book smuggling. They stopped the balloons and they sent them. Some of them went in the mail. Some of them were distributed from bookshops and distribution centers in the West when travelers from the East were allowed to come into the West. As the 50s progressed, they could show up in, for instance, a suburban house in Chiswick, which was owned by a Polish emigre, and he would hand out three or four copies of books, which the CIA were funding for free, as on the proviso that they took them home to their home country.
You'd be saying, you know, this is very Heath Robinson, but the two questions is, one, the network gets set up. Presumably there is an underground network as a hangover from secret services in the Second World War over on the other side of the Iron Curtain? Is this like-minded people who've got a sort of underground network? Because they have to make a contact, don't they? Because otherwise there's no point just sending random copies of 1984 over on a balloon, because it could end up anywhere. And you want it to be most effective, you need it to be targeted and know it's going to get around.
Well, they started after the balloons. The mail operation initially was sent to names and addresses that were culled from East European phone directories. So they were kind of randomized. But then as the program developed, it got more and more sophisticated, and they started targeting the kind of influencers of the time, if you like. So kind of academics and journalists and party members and military people, people who wouldn't get into trouble for owning this kind of material. And then as time progressed, they knew exactly who they were targeting on the other side. And in fact, the operation turned into a sort of print supply network, because in the 80s in Poland, there was a huge underground press, and emigre Poles in the West would send in books and print supplies to their friends who were still in the Eastern Bloc, and they would reproduce these books on the underground presses illegally in Poland.
This blew my mind when I read about this, because so there are underground printing presses running in Poland in the 80s. Incredibly dangerous. You know, Jaruzelski's government is in its death throes, with Solidarność and all that. But I mean, we were all talking about Heath Robinson and it's all very jolly, but if you're discovered in, say, 1959 with a copy of a banned book, Solzhenitsyn or something like that, you're in big trouble. I mean, people are tortured for having this literature on them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the punishments sort of varied slightly as time progressed. So in the Stalinist period, sure, you could be tortured for the most minor offenses, and certainly promoting illegal literature or reproducing it was a serious issue all the way through. By the time we get to the late, well, around about 1980, there's a kind of period of liberalization, and you can pretty much do what you like. But then, as you say, Jaruzelski comes in and declares martial law, and then suddenly the punishments get very draconian again, and people are rounded up and arrested and put in internment camps and so on. And then, as the 80s progress, things become a bit more liberal again. But I like to think of it a bit like we view drugs. Possession is a slightly lesser crime than supplying, and supplying is probably slightly less than actually manufacturing the stuff. So depending on your kind of level of criminality, you face very different sentences.
I'm only carrying half a paperback, officer. Please let me off. Looking at, tell me, this is it George Mindon who is the head of this? I mean, what did you discover about him as a person, in when you were writing the CIA book club?
Well, Mindon, like many of the people who were working on this program, was an émigré himself. So he was Romanian by birth. He had to flee the Eastern Bloc at the end of the Second World War when Romania was put into the kind of Stalinist zone. He ended up in the States. He married an American and settled in New York and joined the Free Europe Committee, which was the sort of propaganda, psychological warfare wing, if you like, of the CIA at that point. And he joined the nascent book program and ran the book program for, more than 3 decades. So he was really the mastermind behind the whole thing. And he would run his operation out of this nondescript tower block in Manhattan, in Park Avenue South. It's still there. It was called the International Literary Center, and it sort of pretended to be a charitable philanthropic organization that was interested in promoting East European literature, but in fact it was always funded by the CIA. And yeah, he had a whole team of people there, working in different languages, mostly, as I say, emigres from the Eastern Bloc, so they knew exactly what they were up against, and they knew the importance of getting uncensored information into the Eastern Bloc to, people that they used to live among,
So, how did you come across this story? Because you've got a special affinity to for books. Because I mean, one of the previous books you've written was The Book Smuggler's Timbuktu. I read it; it's an amazing book. I mean, I've absolutely loved this Book Smuggler's Timbuktu. And in fact, I've lent that out. And you can always tell when a book is popped because you lend it to somebody and you never see it again. So, yeah, indeed. How did you come across? And the Book Smuggler's Timbuktu. Listeners, if you haven't ordered it, go and order it via the TRE website, because it's a brilliant book. So how did you come across this particular book, the subject for the CIA book club? How did it cross your radar, as it were?
Well, that's very kind, Giles. We spoke around that time of Timbuktu, you may remember.
Yeah.
As you say, I have this kind of interest in culture and international affairs or kind of war. And so I was sort of looking in this kind of area, I guess. And then I saw, I don't know if you recall, there was a British philosopher called Roger Scruton who died a few years ago. And I read in an obituary of Roger Scruton that he used to not only take books into the Eastern Bloc himself, but would encourage his students to do so as well. And I thought this was kind of interesting. It kind of tapped into this idea of literary influencing that I'd, that was quite, had parallels with Timbuktu, though of course they're very different stories. And then I started digging and found this CIA book program, and thought no one had really put that together in a kind of narrative sense before. So I, that set me on the kind of route.
And I mean, are there sort of documents? Did you find diaries? Are there newspaper reports? How do you get sort of the information together to write, a compelling narrative, as it were?
Well, a lot of it's done from interviewing. So I spent a lot of time in Poland interviewing people who'd actually been involved in the operation. Minden himself left behind some reports that he used to write when he visited his contacts in Europe, which were very useful because I could work out from them who he had been speaking with and who was in his network, and then approach them if they were still alive. And then at one point I met a very fascinating guy who used to be the chief historian of the CIA, and he had the CIA keep all these documents classified. So the actual material relating to it, to the program, apart from Minden's reports, is not available. But this chief historian had written his own book about this program, and even made a film about it, which the CIA had paid $1 million to fund. But both of these things are still classified, so no one's ever seen them apart from people within the CIA. So he was not able to tell me exactly, of course, what was in them, but I could kind of have conversations with him, and the stuff that was kind of in the public domain or close to it, we could talk about.
Did it make a difference, do you think, John? I mean, to the people that you spoke to, did they believe that it was worth the risks, in some cases, the punishment that they took? Do you think the CIA Book Club actually had an effect on the grand political stage?
Yeah, I think it had a really significant effect. The CIA often talks about the operation in Afghanistan, which you may know about, which was called Operation Cyclone, which was this big effort to fund and arm the Afghan Mujahideen because the Soviets were in Afghanistan, and it was a kind of a way of leeching away resources and morale from the Soviet Union. And that operation cost hundreds of millions of dollars a year. The book program cost a few million dollars a year. And I think it had a sort of similar effect. And the people who I spoke to in the Eastern Bloc, dissidents from the 80s, would tell me that it was books that won the war, as far as they were concerned. The books kept them alive, kept their morale going when it seemed like that their task was hopeless. And, you know, it created a whole intellectual elite, if you like, that was brought up on Western literature, that helped bring down the communist government in Poland. And Poland, of course, was the first communist regime to fall in the Eastern Bloc, and then they all toppled after that. And it also provided a kind of ready-made intellectual class that was able to come out of the Eastern Bloc in 1989 and knew how to kind of operate in the kind of free world that they were entering at that time.
What are you hoping that people will take, will people discover from the CIA Book Club?
I hope they'll take a sense that free information is very important, that censorship is essentially wrong. And I hope they'll also kind of learn a lesson about propaganda, because we seem to be going through a time when, for instance, book bans are coming back, particularly in the US, and when propaganda and disinformation are all around us in a way that they simply weren't even 10 years ago. And I think our societies need to be informed and educated about how propaganda works, and so we can kind of try and discern what the truth is.
The book is called The CIA Book Club, The Best Kept Secret of the Cold War. It's by Charlie English. You can order it via our own virtual bookstore. Charlie, if people want to engage in conversation with you in the nicest possible way, where should they go?
To engage in conversation with me?
Do you do social media? Do you do LinkedIn? Do you TikTok from a caravan somewhere in Yorkshire? Where's the best place to find you, Charlie?
I'm not big on TikTok, but you can find me on X, as they now call it, and Instagram too.
Right, well, do yourselves a favour, ladies and gentlemen. If you've not read it already, do a double order. Go and get the CIA Book Club. Order as well the book Smugglers of Timbuktu, because it's absolutely brilliant. But this one is called the CIA Book Club. You can order it via the TRE virtual bookstore. Charlie, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you once again.
Thank you. You too, Giles.